Hi, this is Warren Olney. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast of To the Point. And I want to tell you about another podcast that's available here at KCRW, and that's the program DNA, hosted by Francis Anderton. Francis is well connected in the industry of design and architecture and art. She used to be editor of an architecture magazine. She knows the trends before they happen. She'll be able to fill you in on them. You can find DNA on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The New Egypt, same as the old? I'm Mark Cooper, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. 3 years after the Arab Spring in Egypt, it seems a long, cold winter has returned. Former strongman Mubarak has been cleared of all charges from the 2011 killings. A new general, el-Sisi, has consolidated power as president, and thousands of religious and secular opposition activists are in jail. Today we'll discuss whether the new Egypt has become the same old Egypt. On today's Talking Point, how do UPS and FedEx move all those millions of packages during the holidays? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Mark Cooper, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Former Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak is out of legal jeopardy. Another military strongman sits as president, and the opposition is in jail. In Egypt, it looks like the Arab winter has set in. On today's Talking Point, we'll hear about the corporate meteorologists who keep all those UPS and FedEx planes up in the air and their deliveries on time. First, this news update. It was chaos last night on Capitol Hill as both parties in the House scrambled to pass a $1 trillion spending bill to keep the government from shutting down. Republicans faced flak from their right wing, while liberal Democrats, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi, bucked the White House and balked at approving the measure. In the end, it passed by a small bipartisan majority. But the drama isn't over. Now it could get hung up in the Senate. We're joined by Manu Raju, senior congressional reporter for Politico. Thanks, Manu.
Thanks for having me.
Manu, quickly, last night there was doubt as to whether or not this was even going to pass the House. When the vote finally came up, which party, the Democrats or the Republicans, ceded just enough ground to get it over the hurdle?
It was Democrats. It seemed all along that Republicans would need a sizable amount of Democrats, at least several dozen. And the question that evening was how many Democrats would really buck their leadership, Nancy Pelosi, who, as you mentioned, came out and opposed this measure. But that's what required the White House to really step up and do an intense lobbying effort. Late in the day yesterday, Obama was on the phone, Biden was on the phone with members, and then Dennis McDonough, the White House chief of staff, was sent to Capitol Hill in a closed-door evening meeting. It was a very tense setting. Lots of members were very upset about it. But McDonough said, look, this is the best deal we can get right now. We need a long-term deal, not a short-term spending bill. We need to put the economy back on a sound footing. And that was enough to sway enough members. And what was also added to the drama was that Nancy Pelosi's own leadership team bucked her, too. Steny Hoyer, number two, was whipping to try to get folks to support the bill. So Democrats were really fractured, and at the end of the day, they barely gave enough support to get that out of the House.
Well, I know you certainly caught the importance of it, but not everybody looks at the Beltway as carefully as you do. It's quite a moment when an incumbent president finds resistance from his own party leadership. If I understand it correctly, the Democrats were upset about what you might call two poison pills that were in the bill, one that gave some favors to banking interests and another one that raised campaign contribution limits. What is the comeback that the White House has on those sort of issues, which it does not generally support?
Yeah, the White House says, look, they weren't happy with those, the inclusion of those provisions either. But they say, look, this was a compromise, and this was a negotiation. Had we not have compromised, it would have been a lot worse. Barbara Mikulski, the Maryland Democrat who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee, was the lead negotiator for Senate Democrats. And she says that at the beginning of the negotiation, Republicans were demanding a lot more to water down the Dodd-Frank financial services law.
Right.
And what she ended up ultimately agreeing on was one provision affecting how derivatives are traded. And that was something that she said was something that she had to do as a concession, but she was able to beat back what she believed were even more draconian provisions. So that's what the White House said. This is a compromise, but if we waited till next year when Republicans have greater numbers in Congress and control of the Senate, the deal that they would get would be even worse.
Well, right now, the bill is in the Senate, and they have till tomorrow midnight, if I understand, to approve it. That wasn't the original plan. And I also understand, and you can correct me, that as little as one senator can hold this up if they want to. Get out your crystal ball and tell us what's going to happen in the Senate in the next 48 hours.
You know, predicting the Senate is very challenging because you're right. One senator can make an objection and delay the process. If one senator does, and we're expecting, if it's possible, it could come from the far right or far left of in the Senate. It could come from the likes of Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions and Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who are demanding a vote to defund the president's immigration executive action. Or it could come from the far left of the Democratic caucus, from Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts Democrat, who's been upset with those very Dodd-Frank provisions that were in the bill. It's not clear if they will. And if they do object, Harry Reid, the majority leader, could make a procedural motion to overcome that objection. But that would take several days and actually would occur on Monday after the current stop measure expires on Saturday.
Amazing.
So the question right now in the Senate is whether there'll be cooperation to have a vote today, Friday, and get this done, and we don't know the answer to that right now.
Okay. Taking this beyond this vote, this controversy was really sparked by Elizabeth Warren, the junior senator from Massachusetts. Is there going to be a Warren wing now of the party when the smoke settles? And we have only about 15, 20 seconds for your answer.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. That side of the Democratic caucus has really grown in strength. And it's really grown frustrated with what they believe were not aggressive actions taken by the Obama administration against some of the bad actors on Wall Street. And you've seen Senate Democratic leaders respond to that by elevating Warren to the leadership. So absolutely.
Manoraju, congressional reporter for Politico, thanks very much.
Thank you.
In a moment, is the Egyptian revolution dead on To the Point?
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Mark Cooper, back with To the Point. 3 years ago, the world was awestruck by the uprising in Cairo's Tahrir Square. Egyptian strongman Hosni Mubarak was pushed out of power and put into jail. Since then, the newly elected president, Mohamed Morsi, was himself overthrown in a military coup, and another former general, al-Sisi, now sits as president. The opposition, meanwhile, sits in jail. Is it game over for democracy and Egypt? Joining us first today is David Kirkpatrick, the New York Times bureau chief in Cairo. Thanks for coming aboard, David.
Good talking to you.
You wrote that, to answer my rhetorical question, you wrote that what we're seeing in Egypt now is even a more authoritarian system than the Mubarak regime. Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And it's a commonplace here. Everybody's talking about it, especially among the sort of liberal or activist crowd. Mubarak was, if you will, a kind of a soft autocrat. He was an old sclerotic dictator who allowed a considerable amount of leeway in terms of the free press, for example. You couldn't insult him personally. You couldn't insult the military. But there were a lot of things you could say about faulting people in his government or actions of his government. And at the same time, there were visible tensions between the courts in particular and the presidency trying to restrain Mubarak's power. It was obvious that there was dissent in the military ranks about some elements of his agenda, and the military and the police were at odds. So the bureaucracy was fairly fractured and at odds, and things were shifting and moving, and there was a lot you could get away with. All of that is gone. There is total unanimity. The press, whether the state-owned or the private press, speaks with one voice. Insulting any of the precepts of the government can get you locked up in jail. And there is absolute unity among the many organs of the state behind President Abdel Fattah Sisi. They're all very, very glad to be rid of this revolutionary period in which their vested interests were in jeopardy.
David, those analysts who write about Egypt sometimes refer to something called the deep state, the underlying power structure that is there in spite of what is superficially on top politically. Is that what we're seeing now? Is the regime that's in power now composed basically of the same forces that undergirded Mubarak?
Yeah, you know, during the period when President Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood was in power, the Islamists like to use the phrase the deep state to talk about the various vested interests within the media elite and the government bureaucracy and the military in particular that were the backbone of the old regime and seemed to be against change, they felt. They borrowed that term from the Turkish experience. At the time, it sounded sort of conspiratorial, but really that fear has been vindicated. What we saw immediately after the coup in July of 2013 is that the force of the deep state really snap back into action. And now we see Mubarak's men back in positions of power.
Well, al-Sisi came to power in what was clearly, at least by many people's analysis, a military coup. The U.S. Was hesitant to use that term, but it sure looked and smelled like a coup. And then he subsequently held an election. Meanwhile, the opposition is in jail, and the main opposition, the Islamic Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood, rather, is barred and banned. Is there any other opposition, and are they also in jail?
No, there is no opposition. There are a few activists here and there, but they're very few, and they're afraid to go out in March. You know, the April 6th group is a secular, left-leaning youth activist group that was very, very brave under Mubarak, that held protests when no one else would. Their leaders were jailed and tortured from time to time, and they kept on fighting. They're no longer fighting because now the police use live ammunition right away. They've had protesters shot and seriously wounded, and they sweeping arrests, people jailed for many years at a time just for unauthorized street protests. So it's the new government has really broken the back of any opposition at the moment.
David, quickly, what about the U.S. position on that? They've attached all sorts of riders to the $1.5 billion in ongoing aid or whatever it is, close to that figure, to Egypt. But most people think that those riders can all be, those human rights riders can all be easily overcome, and that the U.S. is going to continue to fund this government.
Yeah, that's right. Secretary of State John Kerry has basically said, you know, it's coming, we're going to get it done, full funding is going to be restored. And it seems that the dynamic at the moment is that the administration would like to restore the funding. They would like to do it without having to sign some sort of humiliatingly nonsensical declaration that this government is moving towards democracy when it obviously is not. And the only problem they faced really was the Congress, because there were some prominent figures in the previous Senate, in particular Senator Leahy of Vermont, who was in a position, he was animated about this and concerned about U.S. funding of despots abroad, and I think he might have caused problems for the administration. But now that the Republicans have taken over the Senate, I think they're not going to have as much trouble getting back to the status quo in terms of full U.S. funding for the Egyptian government and the Egyptian military.
David Kirkpatrick in Cairo for The New York Times. Stay with us for a moment. Let me also introduce Rami Khoury, syndicated columnist for The Daily Star based in Beirut. Rami is now a senior research fellow at the American University of Beirut and senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. He joins us from Boston. Rami, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
What caused this reversal? Why? How could, in such a short period, could you move in 3 years from sort of unbridled hope to square one?
I think it was a convergence of several things. The total incompetence of the opposition forces in Egypt during the elections and after the elections, their inability to come together in any way to be able to push the constitutional process forward, the total incompetence and greed of the Morsi government, the Muslim Brotherhood government, when after he won the presidency, the mass fear of Egyptians, a kind of hysterical fear that things were falling apart. There was electricity shortages, gasoline shortages, security on the street was getting a little bit worse, job creation was not moving. There was a kind of a panic. And then the reassertion of the deep state, what Yazid Zaire at Carnegie calls the officer's republic. It's a wonderful phrase. Hmm. With thousands and thousands of former military people appointed to positions all over the country, at governorate level, national level, NGOs, everything. So the deep state reasserted itself very forcefully. And the final push by the armed forces under Sisi to actually bring all this together and to take power again. So I think it's a shame, but it's not totally without rational process. I think we can see why it happened, and therefore we can probably see the way out of this dilemma in the future, but that's going to take some time.
Well, I'm going to ask you that question then. We've seen with other revolutions that they have their ups and downs, so to speak. They go through different periods of push and pull, and then often there's a plain counter-revolution. Has the counter-revolution occurred in the sense that everything, any hope of change is cut off, or do you really see some light somewhere?
Well, I don't know if we can even call what happened in 2011 a revolution. It was a popular revolt and an uprising, and it overthrew Mubarak. But there was no organized mechanisms by which the people who overthrew the previous government could take hold of the process of transition to a democratic system, as happened in Tunisia more successfully. So the opposition forces, the revolutionary youth, the Muslim Brothers, they were all doing slightly different things. And what happened, happened. So the counter-revolution, the reassertion of power by the armed forces and the old guard clearly has worked, and they're back in the driver's seat right now. But what I suspect is the reality that will overwhelm us all, and Egypt especially, is that the fundamental driving forces of the revolt of 2011, which had been building up for many, many years in Egypt with labor movements, the April 6th movement, the Kefaya movement, the many, many instances of people revolting and rebelling against the Mubarak and military order since 1952, is that those underlying drivers of social stress, economic stress, and political autocracy are all now worse than they were 4 years ago. Unemployment, poverty, disparities, lack of civil freedoms, these are all much worse, and there's 20,000 or so people in jail. Therefore, the situation as it is now cannot hold for a long time. They can keep this the lid on now for another year or so, maybe 2 years. If the Gulf countries provide $10-15 billion a year, which they may or may not, but the one unstoppable force in all of human history is the will of a citizenry to live freely. Mm. And that will is going to be reasserted again, but hopefully in a more organized way the next time it happens. And it will happen the next time. It may not be a street revolution. There may be other ways that this can get done. But I think that what we're living through now is a transition with autocracy and the army and foreign military support and economic support, including American, basically just freezing things as they are. But you cannot freeze the fragmentation and the economic crumbling of a society as is happening in Egypt. So something is going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years, and we don't know what it is.
Rami Khoury, stay with us. Let me come back to David Kirkpatrick in Cairo for the New York Times. David, what is the feeling on the street, if one can generalize? There must be a certain quota of fear, but is there also is that also mixed with resignation, especially given the events, the recent events of mass arrests and condemnation of hundreds to the death penalty?
Well, your guest Rami is right. The underlying factors, all the underlying complaints and problems that drove the 2011 revolt, none of them have gone away. So they're all pent up, and they're going to come out someday, some way. At the moment, however, there is a very complicated, sort of psychologically unstable mix of resignation and fear, but also a hope that I think to many outsiders feels naive. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who may at the same time feel, oh dear, we're stuck with another autocrat. And, gosh, I hope this is a better autocrat. I mean, maybe he really will turn the economy.
Right. I was going to ask you, is there, having reported myself on situations similar to this, there you usually find a undetermined section of the population who is quite comfortable with this, or if not quite comfortable, at least is supportive because it has pushed politics out and there is relative peace and quiet.
Yeah, they call it the party of the couch here in Egypt. But it's a difficult proposition for people who've grown up in the West to swallow, because we're accustomed to thinking that autocracy breeds corruption, corruption breeds waste. You can never turn around an economy when it's so deeply corrupt. And so I hear people say, well, look, President Sisi is doing some good things. It seems he's bringing in a lot of aid from the Gulf. He's got an ambitious project to expand the Suez Canal. Maybe he'll really be able to turn it around. But over the long run, you have to suspect that if it's still a system that is so deeply corrupt and built on payoffs, it's going to run into those forces that drove the 2011 revolt in the first place.
Mm. Briefly, how does this affect the renewed or continuing support of the U.S. For this regime? How does that affect the image of the U.S. Among the masses in Egypt? There must have been a moment in 2011 where the political capital of the U.S. Rose with its somewhat support of the ouster of Mubarak, but that's all gone now.
Well, there's a really deep schizophrenia here towards the U.S. First of all, the support for Mubarak here was perceived as very much belated. His body was on a stretcher on the way out of the room
right. By
the time Obama called for his ouster. And even though the U.S. has given an enormous amount of money to Egypt, $1.5 billion a year now, there's an incredible amount of resentment and conspiracy theories about the United States and its agenda and its role in the Middle East, all of which is not that hard to get your mind around when you think about U.S. support for Israel, U.S. support for what happened to Hamas, U.S. support for the coup in Iran. It's easy to put together a nefarious picture of the U.S. agenda, not to mention the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And yet,
David,
when
you
balance that against the aid, it is a little bit crazy. Go ahead.
I was just going to say we need to take a break. David, I want to thank you for joining us from Cairo. David Kirkpatrick is the New York Times bureau chief. We'll continue this conversation after a brief break. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Mark Cooper, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To The Point. We're talking about Egypt, 3.5 years after the Arab Spring. Well, our previous two guests have a pretty harsh view of the current regime, but not everybody does. And among those who might be a little bit better disposed to it is Omar Reda. He's a resident of Cairo and an investment banker, partner in a boutique financial firm. Mr. Reda, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
What's the good news about Egypt from your point of view? I think you've heard our previous two guests. Is it as dark as they say, or are they missing the light?
No, I think they're missing a lot of things. I would agree with them that some of the things here are not perfect, especially having a with the military taking over. However, on the more positive side, that you have now a stable government, you have a government, I mean, compared to look just around the region, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Sudan, practically everything, Hamas, Gaza, you know. So practically every country around us is in a big mess. And many of them have tried to use the American, you know, democratization like in Iraq. But now that we have a more stable government, people can start to focus more on the economy. And the government, again, there's it leaves a lot to be desired, but they're still trying to do some right things. Some laws are changing, which I think are very positive, more towards an open market. We are seeing now actually lots of foreign investors coming. We had the biggest U.S. delegation here, a business delegation here last month, the biggest that I've seen in my 20 years of work. There's lots of European investors, Asian investors, obviously Arabs are coming. So I think it's not as bleak as the two gentlemen have presented.
We have a lot of examples of authoritarian regimes that have increased the economic activity in their country and open markets from China. I guess China would be the primary example. Are accepting what you said about the flowering of business and business interests, what about the question of democracy? Is that just not important, or do you believe our guests also overstated the degree to which this government has restricted it?
Actually, it's a very good question. Like for me, when I went to Tahrir in 2011 and I revolted against the Mubarak and then against the military in 2012 and then against the Muslim Brotherhood, I'm very pro-democracy. However, when you look at the general population, unfortunately, democracy is not number one. When you go to this on the street and you ask, you want democracy, they tell you, what did democracy do for Iraq? Or you know, when they had elections, didn't work, Hamas had. So democracy is not number one, it is livelihood. The ability to find a job and to be able to live comfortably. This idea of that democracy and freedom, the Western version of freedom, is an absolute essential thing that all Egyptians long for, unfortunately, is not the number one priority. And even when you talk to the revolutionaries, which like I did, because one thing I think Mr. Khoury said, which was very right, is that the revolutionary, they couldn't actually unite and drive their democratic agenda forward simply because they didn't have one. Muslim Brotherhood don't believe in democracy. The leftists, which are the 6th of April, they're extremely autocratic in their own way. So this idea of a democracy that encompasses all, it doesn't exist. Like the Muslim Brotherhood thought of democracy as the one of the majority basically rules against everybody else. So this idea of democracy needs a little bit more work
in order for people to understand it, I think.
Stay with us, Omar. Let me also bring in Mona El-Tahawi. She's an Egyptian-American journalist in Cairo who covered the Arab Spring and author of the forthcoming book, Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. Mona, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm going to suppose by the title of your book that you're hardly a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. Do you have some begrudging support to President al-Sisi because at least he has pushed the Islamists away from the levers of power?
No, I have zero support for Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. I do not support one fascist against another group of fascists. I considered the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists who wanted power in Egypt to be fascists who use God and religion, and I consider Sisi to be a fascist who uses the military force against the people. And I reject both forms of fascism. I also reject this idea that the more investment Egypt brings in, the better people's livelihoods will become, as Omar just said, because I take you back during the Mubarak regime, when Egypt was one of the emerging markets, as they were called. And, you know, we often touted this idea that the Egyptian economy was growing by this fantastic 6% a year. But I want to remind your listeners that the only people who benefited from this was the regime and its cronies. The ordinary average Egyptian was still struggling to put food on his or her table. The average Egyptian was still struggling with trying to find a job, and the average Egyptian continues to struggle. So this idea that democracy and freedom is a luxury we can afford, I reject this idea utterly, as much as I reject this idea that money is the solution to everything, because in a country that is as corrupt as Egypt, and in a country that is run by fascists and dictators, any money that comes in is going to go to the top echelon. It's not going to go into the disadvantaged neighborhoods that nobody pays attention to.
I'm curious to know how you operate as a journalist and to what degree journalists face a threat in or are facing a threat in Egypt. And we've also been reading about crackdowns in other areas, not just political dissidents, but also among the gay population of Cairo.
Well, I mean, in 2011, as with many other people, I was assaulted by the Egyptian riot police, and they broke both my arms and sexually assaulted me. So this was during the year of the revolution, and I was detained for 12 hours. Any threats that I face these days are also threats that I share with too many people in Egypt, and that is threats that often come very underhandedly from a media that is completely controlled by the regime, and they will basically defame and libel us by insinuating that we are foreign agents and that we are working against the interests of Egypt. Now, there are too many journalists in Egyptian jails these days. As you know, the number of political prisoners has risen exponentially. There are at least 30,000 prisoners of conscience in Egyptian jails, and they include three journalists from Al Jazeera who were convicted of ridiculous charges of, you know, supporting quote unquote terrorism. So that we have journalists in jail and journalists who are, as I said, threatened as they go about their day-to-day business and try to do a job. Now, as you mentioned, these crackdowns on Egypt's gay community, this turning against anybody who represents the slightest threat says to me that Sisi's regime is not a confident regime. If you are a confident leader, you do not need to go around and round up gay men from bathhouses and humiliate them on public television as you take them out, you know, stripped naked. You also don't need to push the message that you must be exactly like me or I will send you to jail. We have a situation in Egypt right now where morality is being used against people. Essentially, the message is, if you are not a conservative Muslim man, because this is what the regime represents, a very conservative version of Islam. And, you know, I urge your listeners to forget this idea that Sisi got rid of the Islamists and he's a secular. Our regimes have never been secular. They've only been secular in name. They use religion when it benefits them. Some of them use religion openly, as the Muslim Brotherhood did. And Sisi's regime is using it now because it's turning a homophobic population against a sexual minority and is claiming it is doing this for the sake of the nation's good. As you know, they fight armed militants in Sinai, and foreign embassies are closing ostensibly because of security threats. So, you know, the question here is our regime really protecting us from anything? And who's going to protect us against our regime?
Let me go back to Omar Reda. I know that I suspect you're more interested in business and finance than you are in religious purity. Are you concerned that after pushing out the Muslim Brotherhood, that this secular regime, at least in name, is in fact pushing on the moral front, as Mona just said?
I don't think that actually President Sisi is in full control of everything is being done. I mean, the idea that there's one plan that to round up everybody who's different, I don't think it works that way. I think this idea of government being anti-gay has always been there, unfortunately. I mean, in Mubarak's time, it happened. So it's not something new for the Ministry of Interior. They do like to crack down on that just so they appear to be holding the morality, or their version at least of morality. So they tend to do that every once in a while, unfortunately. So it's I disagree with the idea that this is something new. Unfortunately, we've had that all for a very long time. And this is one of the reasons why the revolution, the first one at least, succeeded, was because the interior ministry was were very brutal.
Let me come back to – thank you, Omar. Let me come back to Rami Khoury, who's a columnist and editor-at-large for the Beirut-based Daily Star. Rami, you've been listening to a lot of this conversation. Give us some notion of how this situation in Egypt now fits into the regional mosaic. What are the reverberations of the reversal of the Egyptian movement, Egypt being the biggest and most important Arab country in the world?
Well, I think there are many links directly. I mean, obviously, people in the Gulf, like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and others, are actively supporting Sisi and pushing Egypt to maintain the status quo that it has now reverted to. And actually, what's happening now is worse than the situation under Mubarak, as we heard. So there are direct links between events in Egypt and events around the region, and also sentiments around the region, where a lot of people were uncomfortable with popular revolutions, which were, by the way, not Islamist. The uprisings were had no Islamist involvement of any significance. But then the Islamists took over in the elections to some extent in different countries. And the two things that happened, which is the free will of the citizenry and the incumbency of Islamist democratically elected legitimate governments, scares the daylights out of the monarchies and many other people, and probably also the U.S. government, if we can judge by how the U.S. government has behaved in relation to the uprisings all around the region. So
well,
Egypt is a...
I was going to ask you about the U.S. In this. It seems almost inconceivable, given the history of the U.S., that it's going to suspend in any significant way or hold back any significant support from the Egyptian regime as it currently exists. As you know, the administration was reticent to even call the military coup a military coup. What are the ramifications of that, given the current position of the U.S. in the region, which does not seem very opportune?
Well, I think the track record of the U.S. in the region is pretty clear. I mean, it has produced Olympic-level chaos in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and with its drone killings all around, the assassinations all around the regions, and torture. So the U.S. is busy doing a lot of terrible things in different parts of the Middle East, and I think its fear is that if you have real democratic government emerging in places like Egypt or other big Arab countries, it probably fears that and finds it just much easier to keep the clamps on and leave the army in power. At the same time, you know, intelligent Americans understand that that's a recipe for future revolution. I mean, it was the Americans that gave the world the idea of the consent of the governed. It's an idea that they don't seem to like to support very much in their export industry. So there's a real moral dilemma for the United States that Americans have to sort out. But in the meantime, Egypt is the most dramatic example of how the old guard in certain Arab countries will reassert itself and clamp down, how citizens will go along with this. The Egyptian people, those who voted, which wasn't very many of them, but they voted for Sisi. So technically, on paper, Sisi is a legitimately elected president. In fact, he probably represents, I don't know, 20-25% of the people, of those who voted in terms of the whole population. But this is a sign that people, you know, Egyptians and Arabs are normal people. They will panic, they will get scared, and they will call in the military as they just did in Egypt. But the lesson is that the people who ruined the Arab world were the military who took power. And the same military cannot fix the Arab world. Egypt historically gave the Arab world two terrible things: military rule starting in 1952, and the creation of ministries of information, which turned individual Arabs into robots, that they were telling us what we could think and what we couldn't think, and what we could hear and read and see. And this is what people rebelled against. The rebellion was all across the Arab world. It wasn't just Egypt and Tunisia. People in the Gulf were tweeting and challenging their government. So there was a massive wholesale rebellion of citizens who wanted to be citizens and not just consumers who go to shopping malls. So I think the Egypt is what we're seeing is one step on the way to people in the Arab world slowly over years sorting out the problems that they have in making a transition to governments that are dignified and legitimate in their eyes.
Thank you, Rami Khoury from the Beirut-based Daily Star. Quickly, let me go back to Mona El-Tahawi. Mona, we only have about a minute. What keeps you fighting? What keeps you on your feet, given the sort of enormous challenge we hear you facing?
Well, I mean, quite simply, that I believe that we as Egyptians deserve to be free. I believe that our revolution wasn't just against Mubarak. Our revolution was and continues to be against the regime and against all forms of autocracy. And the reason I wrote my book and the reason that I mentioned the sexual revolution is because I'm deeply committed to the idea of taking what began as a political revolution into our homes and making it a social and a sexual revolution that rises up against the autocracy in the home. Because unless we have those double revolutions where we're rising up against all forms of patriarchy and autocracy, we're just going to end up replacing one dictator with another, which is what we've done in Egypt. And I believe that we deserve to be free of all forms of dictatorships, not just military rule, but Islamist rule and the rule of the father and the brother who is keeping women at home when they know that it's too late to keep women at home now. Egyptian women, as of women across the region, know that we belong in every area in our country, and we will be free.
Mona El-Tahawi, thank you very much. American Egyptian journalist based in Cairo. Thanks to all of our guests in this discussion, David Kirkpatrick from the New York Times and investment banker Omar Reda. And again, Rami Khoury from the Beirut Daily Star. Did you know that companies like Federal Express and UPS have war rooms of meteorologists to keep everything on schedule? I didn't. Back in a moment with To The Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
I'm Mark Cooper, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with today's Talking Point. Well, almost a billion packages are going to be shipped this holiday season by UPS and FedEx. The question is, who keeps all those planes in the sky and on time, even when you're facing the sort of blizzards and snowstorms that have become, almost weekly? The answer comes from Washington Post reporter Drew Harrell, who joins us now. Drew Harwell. Thanks for joining us, Drew.
Thanks for having me.
Drew, you write about some mysterious place called Snow Kong. Sounds like something out of 7 Days in May. What is it?
Yeah, well, these meteorologists, they put out these Snow Kong alerts, which sounds very military. It's almost like DEFCON alerts. But they, like you said, run these immense war rooms that track the weather all over the world and in airports across America. Tracking where their cargo jets are going that are full of these big packages that are, often delivered from warehouses in California or manufacturing plants in China. So they're watching these at all times all over the world, and they send out these snow con alerts when a blizzard or a snowstorm is going to set them back a few
seconds. That's in case you can't see the 6 feet of snow in Albany.
That's right, yeah.
Now, that these guys aren't just, and gals, I'm sure, aren't just flight traffic controllers. They're actually meteorologists, some of them, aren't they?
They are. They're college-trained expert meteorologists. Almost all of them are at the top of their game, and they're employed by these shipping companies like FedEx and UPS and the Postal Service to watch the weather in a way that a lot of us never think about it, and even in a more delicate, nuanced way than even the TV meteorologists look at it. They're watching for dew points and snow and blizzards and in the summer hurricanes and monsoons, because any one of those things can sidetrack this incredibly advanced network of cargo jets and trucks they have.
How much, I know it would probably take hours to outline it all, but just give us a quick thumbnail. What do their backup systems look like? I mean, what happens if a plane motor isn't running, or if a runway is closed, or anything like that?
Sure. Well, they have the basic sort of preventive measures, which is if a plane's in the air and they're trying to land in Portland and there's a blizzard there, they'll maybe reroute it to Seattle and have a fleet of trucks or something move it from one to the next. But if desperate measures come, they'll often send in special jets that are sort of flying across the country at all times to sort of sweep in and pretty much save the day and pick up packages if they need to and reroute them to their destination. It's a fascinating sort of rescue system.
It is sort of like one of those old Cold War movies with the bombers always in the sky. Clearly the holiday period has got to be the toughest period because of the weather and the sheer amount of traffic. But in general, is this shipping job getting harder as different vendors and companies compete with each other for quicker and faster shipping?
Yeah, I think it is, because more people are buying things online and more companies are offering faster shipping, quicker, shorter deadlines. And so any 1 second or minute of delay can potentially, off route one whole leg of the journey. So I think it is becoming tougher. And as we saw last winter, the retailers promised a lot, and there were actually a series of delays when too many packages were in the air and the polar vortex and these icy storms were slowing everything down. So it was this kind of perfect storm of delays. And it's only getting harder as more and more packages are being shipped. And that's why watching the weather is so important for these guys.
Well, as I'm sure you know, last year, Toys R Us and other retailers let people order stuff as late as, almost midnight on December 23rd, arriving for Christmas. And now it's become common practice for Amazon, for its Prime service, to deliver almost anything overnight. And now they're touting same-day delivery in some cities. Is this disrupting the whole shipping world?
It really is. And it's making shoppers think about this whole process differently too. Once we have this kind of convenience, it's very hard for us to think about anything else. The expectation is being set really, really high for these retailers and the manufacturers and the shipping companies too. And so that's making us expect a certain amount of near impossible task, like same day delivery of something we ordered that morning. We're expecting it more. And so when we don't get it, we're kind of flummoxed. And so that's making it really hard for these guys.
Well, we've had these peppering of stories coming from Amazon, promising, or if you will, threatening that they're going to start delivering things by drone, which I really have a lot of difficulty envisioning, but it certainly does raise expectations, right?
Yeah, it does. And that idea is, I think, one of Amazon's most pie-in-the-sky ideas. But they're certainly talking about very fast alternatives like using taxis, using bike messengers to get these things from the warehouse or the store to your doorstep. So it's really fascinating. And Amazon is kind of the biggest gorilla in this game. And so everybody's kind of having to follow their lead and offering what people want, which is to buy something right now and to have it as soon as possible.
Well, Americans have never been known for being very patient. But does this all this rush shipping and overnight shipping and same day shipping change consumer habits and change the psychology of shopping in the United States?
I think so. I think it's all about expectation. And, you know, if we feel like we can get something tomorrow, or if you have Amazon Prime to get it in 2 days for free, you're not going to think that much about hitting buy now because you know you're going to have it so soon. I think it does maybe foment a little bit of impatience or just kind of the desire of wanting to have it as quickly as possible. 20 years ago or 30 years ago, people would look at a catalog and maybe call in an order and forget about it until 2 weeks from then to until they see it at their doorstep and they're happily surprised. And now it's, you know, if you order a doll and it comes across country for free and takes any more than 2 days, you're kind of like, well, what the heck? So it's an interesting kind of quickening of our expectations, and it's making the jobs that these people do in keeping this logistical network going that much more difficult.
Drew Harwell from The Washington Post, thank you. We got to go because I'm waiting for a package to come any moment.
Gotcha. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
To the Point was produced this week by Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Benjamin Gottlieb, Jenny Hamill, and Claire Martin. Technical director is Mike Newport. Our senior producer is Evan George. The managing producer is Sonia Geis. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Mark Cooper, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.